Good afternoon and welcome to the regular briefing by the Pulido, by Lieutenant Governor Karen Pulido and the Baker Pulido administration for the municipal chief executive officers all throughout the Commonwealth of Massachusetts dealing with the COVID-19 pandemic. We deeply appreciate the Lieutenant Governor working on her schedule to be so available and to bring members of the administration to this briefing to provide all of you with the latest information and to answer as many questions as possible. I'm Jeff Beckwith, the Executive Director of the MMA, and we are very pleased to provide the electronic platform for this meeting. We're joined here today by Lieutenant Governor, by Education Secretary Jim Pizer, by Assistant Commissioner of Education Russell Johnston, and by Sean Cronin, who every single municipal official in Massachusetts, I think, knows Sean, but doesn't, for the first time, I think, are seeing flowers behind him during this briefing. So without further ado, Lieutenant Governor, thank you for your extraordinary work and your partnership, and we'll turn the meeting over to you.
Okay, thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. It's a pleasure to be with you to exchange information. That's the sort of the best part of this. I'm not shortchanging Secretary Pizer and his fantastic presentation that he'll make today. But it's really the exchange, the questions that you have, the comments and input that you give us as literally frontline and facing elected officials and administrators across our municipalities. We have our usual lineup here. I see Jana Ferguson from DPH is here. You'll hear from Secretary Pizer and Russell Johnston on from the education side of things. And Sean Cronin, he's the utility player. He can cover a whole lot of territory in our conversations during this time. Let me just start with, we're all very much in tune with what is happening with COVID in our Commonwealth. The governor reported at yesterday's briefing that the Department of Public Health reported 2,263 new cases. The 7-day average positivity rate is 3.25. 65,000 new tests were reported and 7.3 million tests have been reported in total. And since Labor Day, we've seen a sharp increase in both COVID cases and hospitalizations, cases up over 8 times and hospitalizations over 4.5 times larger than Labor Day. So I think these are the numbers that ground all of us in terms of where the virus is, how it's acting at this time. Of course, now heading into the holidays, we're all very mindful of the movements that people have as families, as individuals. You have college kids coming home or leaving this place and going somewhere else. That's all top of mind as we head into the week. And that's why more than a week ago, we started messaging around how to prepare for the holidays in a pandemic, not something that we've had to talk about before. We also know from our testing and tracing and the data that we accumulate through that program that household spread is a major area of concern for us. So with that, we're asking you, all of you, to be aware of our Thanksgiving guidance and to not only be aware of it, but to distribute it. Use all of your social media channels, use all of the messaging boards, use all of the tools available to you to impress upon your residents in your community how to safely conduct themselves over the Thanksgiving holiday. As we all know, you know, being with those in your household is the safest thing to do. If you're mixing with others, obviously keeping that small and wearing face coverings. We need your help. We frankly need your help in just making sure that those messages get out there. Certainly, I would like to talk about the metrics. I'm not going to go through the chart of the gray, green, yellow, and and red in the categories of population. I think most of you are familiar with that, but I do want to just generally state that the update was done with input from a lot of you. For instance, a lot of you were saying, the more we test, the more our case positives go up, but what about the population that I have in my community? And so we were able to update the metrics to have both the reporting of cases per 100,000 residents and the test positivity rate determine the color designation for your community. So it's not one or the other, it's both. And it's partly in that way now because we want communities to continue to test. It's a good measurement tool to understand what's happening with the virus in your community. And when you identify someone that is positive, they can take the necessary precautions for themselves and others around them. But it also is, I think, a fair way for us to determine then as local officials how you can make decisions, especially with your businesses that are operating. And the metrics and the color designation will determine whether you stay in step two of phase three, or if you're not in step two of phase three, how you move forward. Obviously, you can't have a red week in order to move forward. If you have three consecutive red weeks, you can move backwards and it may be hovering in between, but less bouncing around like we were seeing before we changed the metrics. I think the issues also, not only the holidays, but coming up to the winter, I think we're all, you know, feeling like when in March we announced the state of emergency, we thought it would be for a couple of or a few weeks. Well, it turned into a lot longer journey and we've been in the tunnel for a very long time. But as we've been in this tunnel, we can now see some hope and some light at the end of this tunnel with the reports of vaccines being perfected through Pfizer and Moderna. And it's very hopeful to all of us that that vaccine will be distributed in our communities and across our country in a relatively short period of time from now. But we still have a distance to go before we get there. And that's why all of the measures that we work on together are really important to continue to be top of mind. Back on November 6th, some of the things that we did was to look at targeted interventions. So knowing what we could see from our data as the problem spots, how are we going to get to those through targeted interventions, which is leading me to the whole issue of gatherings, because our data is showing that gatherings in places where there aren't, you know, specific rules and protocols, where people are enforcing them, like in a restaurant or a retail shop or even in a manufacturing plant or even at a town hall or a city hall, if it's an unregulated, unsupervised place and people are not adhering to the safety measures, then that has shown that virus spreads pretty easily in a situation like that, and it is bearing out in our numbers. So household spread and spread because of these unsupervised gatherings is a problem spot. So targeted interventions, that would include reducing the gathering size indoors to 10, outdoors to 25 in a private setting, and to 50 and 100 in a supervised setting, like in an event space. The stay-at-home advisory was intended to get to that message around changing your behaviors, changing your habits. You know, go to work, have your kids go to school and learn, but then in the evening hours, you know, go home. You know, finish up your day, go home, and try to, you know, ease up on the gatherings that we feel are contributing to the spread. And then, of course, the targeted intervention in order to get people to change their habits around going home and staying in place to close early those evening activities. And that's where closing places that sell alcohol, like a restaurant or a retail store that sells alcohol, and not allowing that activity to take place after 9:30 was part of the package of things that we felt were appropriate at that time in order to get people to get into a habit of being more mindful of limiting their gatherings and so that we can control this virus as much as possible in the spread. Now, a lot of people are asking, this is the number one question I get many texts and probably you as well. So are you as a state going to close business? Are you going to lock down? Are you going to roll back? I hear this multiple times in a day, and I'm sure that you do too. And I think it's partly because the media is obviously spending a lot of time on it. You're seeing other states around us and other states take different action steps. But many states did not take the action steps that we took now a couple of weeks ago. And we want to continue to have a targeted approach to targeting problems and looking at those problems rather than a rollback or closure. And I would also add that we are in a very different place than we were in the spring. We have PPE in a stockpile that would last us through the end of 2021. We have the ability to surge, hospital space in field hospitals. We announced last week with Eric Dixon at UMass the ability to set up within a relatively short period of time a field hospital to have that excess capacity. Our hospitals have protocols in place around how to make sure that they are able to deliver care to not only people that come in with COVID illnesses, but also other emergency needs and critical elective procedures that need to take place. And remember, in the spring, we did not have that capacity. So elective procedures were completely shut down, and we want to avoid that. We want a health care system that can continue to provide health care to everyone that needs it in this Commonwealth. And we feel ready and able to do that. And of course, back in April, we were testing around 2,000 tests a day, and the turnaround time was much longer. Today, we have that capacity, and oftentimes we're hitting over 100,000 tests a day with a turnaround time of less than 2 days. Having said that, I can see a lot of people are looking at the holiday and looking for tests. That might be one of the subjects we talk about today. Are you seeing much longer lines at testing, both the Stop the Spread sites and other, some of our Project Beacon sites? And I think that people are listening in the sense that they want to get tested before they go visit someone, or they're getting tested because they're going somewhere. On testing, we did work with our regional colleagues and put out a guidance around college kids that are leaving the Commonwealth to go someplace and asking the colleges to have them tested 72 hours before going. And we're asking other states to make sure that college kids coming here are doing the same. I think that was a powerful message on a regional basis to have released today. And I know the secretary is going to talk more in depth about that. On a slightly different note, today we announced MassWorks grants. And it puts a smile to everyone's face when we talk about MassWorks and economic development and a program that is certainly tested and is very effective. This was, again, another competitive round. We announced $68 million with 36 awards today. We had a number of communities that were first-time applicants that were awarded, and we had also a number of communities that fell within that category of under 7,000 in population. And as you know, 10% of the MassWorks awards need to be devoted to some of those smaller communities. So that we will continue to work on with all of you, not only the response to this virus, but to economic recovery and our economic future in terms of new development and opportunities within your communities. I think I'll just close at that so that we have plenty of time to hear from Secretary Pizer and to address your questions and concerns today.
Thank you very much, Lieutenant Governor. I know that Secretary Pizer is right there and ready to unmute himself and dive right in. We do have a lot of questions that are in the chat, just as a reminder to all the participants in the meeting. The chat function is where we encourage you, ask you to post your questions. We'll get to as many as of them as we can. We'll summarize this discussion on the MMA website and provide an audio recording of the briefing. Any unanswered questions will be shared with the administration, and when we receive responses, then we'll post those on the MMA website as well. So again, thank you to the entire team, Lieutenant Governors, that you have, and Secretary Pizer, thanks for joining us.
Great, well, thank you, Jeff. Can everybody hear me okay? Good, thank you. So thanks for letting me join you today. Thanks, Governor, for inviting us, and thanks to Russell Johnson for joining me as well. Russell has been leading the charge in terms of the Binex initiative, which I'm going to be talking about in a minute. And he's certainly available to answer any hard questions that you might have. I may even throw the easy ones to him. But Jeff, also, I want to thank you for giving me an opportunity to wear a tie. That doesn't happen very often. I was going to wear a jacket, but now that I'm seeing you wearing the jacket and tie, I'm glad I didn't, you know, try to compete with you. So it's good to, you know, be in a situation where I feel like a professional again. So thanks for that. So as I think most of you know, Massachusetts is slated to receive over 2 million of these Abbott Binex Now tests from the federal government, 300,000 of which have already arrived and are in a DPH warehouse. And Binex, again, as you may be familiar, is an antigen test that provides results within 15 minutes. So it's really sort of a real-time test, doesn't require the kind of waiting that would otherwise be necessary. You don't have to send it off. It happens all sort of right in place as you wait on site. And although states have been given the flexibility to use the kits in the ways that they choose, the federal government has placed a priority on schools, and so has Massachusetts. An evaluation of the test platform was undertaken in Lawrence, and DESE asked all districts, including charter schools, collaboratives, and private 766 schools, to send in a letter expressing their intent to participate in the initial phase of this rollout. And 339 districts responded. After a webinar explaining the sort of parameters and the components of this program, 134 districts opted in, which represents actually a pretty good cross-section of communities throughout the state, different kinds of communities, and obviously in different parts of the Commonwealth. This first phase is designed to support districts that are providing or are planning to provide in-person or in-school instruction for some or all of their students. So obviously, if a district is fully remote, then you know the testing of students and staff is not really particularly necessary. It's only when students are in school, coming into school, staff are coming into school for instruction, that it makes sense to have this resource available. And there are other requirements that schools and districts needed to meet. And I don't think it's overly burdensome, but nonetheless, some districts and schools may have opted out because they may not have been able to easily at least meet the administrative requirements. Specifically, the kits are to be used to test students and staff who present symptoms while they're in school. So this is kind of important to keep in mind, an important element of this program. This is not sort of broad-based surveillance or asymptomatic testing that these kits are designed for, at least not for the moment, but rather they're designed for testing students and staff and getting results back in a very quick way when they are presenting some symptoms. And the primary benefit of all this is to more quickly identify individuals who are COVID positive, in order to get them quickly into isolation and to accelerate the process of identifying and notifying their close contacts, all of which is designed to help limit or prevent the potential transmission of COVID within schools. It's important to note here that this is not intended to be a substitute for or replacement for diagnostic testing or molecular or PCR testing, but rather it's kind of an initial test which has a pretty high correlation to the PCR test. So we feel pretty confident that it's producing an accurate result. But once you've been tested positive through the Binex, not only are you supposed to go home, but you are in fact supposed to get another test in order to confirm the diagnosis. And by doing all this, we're hoping that parents and staff will gain greater confidence about the safety of in-person, in-school learning, thereby enabling more students to get back into their regular classrooms. As I said, the kits are not designed for asymptomatic or surveillance testing, and that's in part because they've really at the moment been validated primarily for positive rather than negative cases, although there's further research that's being done along those lines that I'll mention later on. And in any event, the testing, it's important to keep in mind here, the testing is only one tool out of many to mitigate in-school transmission. And, you know, as we've seen already, both here in Massachusetts and in other places around the country, there's still little evidence to suggest that students and staff are contracting COVID in schools when the core health and safety protocols are followed. And what those, you know, protocols are, of course, are, you know, wearing face coverings, maintaining distancing, washing hands, doing the cleaning and disinfecting, and of course, importantly, staying home when you're not feeling well. And just to sort of reiterate the point here, this is not intended to be sort of an alternative testing vehicle for people who really should be staying out of schools because they have symptoms. It's really primarily for students and staff who are getting sick or feeling sick, you know, when they're in school and getting the test quickly accessible while they're there. If they're not feeling well, they shouldn't be coming into school in the first place. They shouldn't be coming into school to get the tests. They should be taking the test if they are starting to feel bad while they're in school. So in other words, you know, the BINEX tests support safe in-person learning, but they are not necessarily one of these core infection control strategies in and of it themselves. So it's good to have, but it is really a supplementary complement to all those other things which are really critical to keeping students and staff safe. Participating districts have to receive a federal waiver to administer these tests. And that comes with certain requirements that they need to meet. I don't think they're particularly onerous, and this is not an uncommon process, but nonetheless, there are some requirements that they need to meet. And they also need to acquire a standing doctor's order to allow them to administer the tests and to, you know, essentially conduct the analysis, which is quite simple. It doesn't really require a whole lot of training, except they do need to be trained and they do need to be administered by healthcare professionals. There are some requirements that schools and districts need to meet. They aren't particularly onerous, but nonetheless, there are some things that they need to comply with. The standing order issue is important. As I said, that is a requirement that they have a standing order from a doctor or a local board of health. We're already hearing some reports that may be a little difficult in some cases to secure. So that may be something where town or city leadership might be helpful. Working through the board, local boards of health to try to make sure that participating districts can get those standing orders to enable them to administer the tests. The other thing just to mention is obviously we're dealing, generally speaking, with minors when we're talking about the student population. And so tests can only be administered with parental consent. And that's another one of the requirements of the program. So once districts have submitted their paperwork back to DESE, essentially attesting that they've completed all the necessary requirements, primarily federal requirements, the kits will be shipped out pretty quickly. So there's not a whole lot of processing that has to happen once the paperwork is submitted. And so hopefully that can be done. That paperwork will start coming in kind of as we speak and certainly next week. And then the kits can start going out of the warehouse as soon as possible after that. So by early December, we're hoping to have the kits in the hands of schools and districts so they can start using them. Obviously, that gives us only a couple of weeks in December, but hopefully we'll be fully up and running as we get into January. And again, hopefully we'll be seeing more and more students in schools, in which case we'll be able to make use of these test kits and hopefully the additional test kits that will be on their way. Let me shift gears for a second there, and then we can come back to this and respond to some more questions. But I did also just want to update you all on some of the changes that we've made to our guidance related to higher education, and in particular with respect to testing protocols for students on residential colleges. And specifically what was announced yesterday is related to when students at residential colleges are leaving campuses for vacations or between semesters, like the one coming up right now with Thanksgiving. You know, prior to this, this actually is a fairly recent shift in our guidance as well. We have set expectations that colleges ought to be testing students on a weekly basis, in some cases more frequently than that, depending on the risk profile of the individual student. So, but that requirement actually didn't or doesn't kick in officially until January. So not all colleges and universities are doing weekly testing yet. Most are, but not all of them. And so what we wanted to clarify was that before students leave campus for Thanksgiving vacation, that they all ought to be tested within 72 hours of going home. And hopefully we'll receive a negative test and all will be well and they'll be able to leave campus. However, if they do receive a positive result of that based on that test, that they should be isolating in place on campus. And the campuses and the colleges would be obligated to provide them with that space. Most of, you know, all of them have spaces set aside for this. Obviously the campuses will be mostly empty over the holidays. So that won't be a particularly burdensome thing, except positive students who are in isolation need to have, you know, meals delivered and other essential services. So it does put a little bit more burden on the colleges. But I think it's a marginal one, and hopefully there won't be too many positive cases. But the intent here is to ensure that colleges are doing what they need to do, as well as students doing what they need to do, to make sure that they're keeping their families and their community safe as they're returning home, whether that home is within Massachusetts or somewhere else in the country. And similarly, when students return, and you know, as many of you may know, a lot of colleges are really kind of shutting down. They're continuing classes remotely after Thanksgiving, but many of them are not inviting students back onto campus or into the residence halls after Thanksgiving. But many are, and in particular, most of our public institutions are inviting students back on campus. Not clear how many will actually come back because most of the courses are available remote, but nonetheless, there will be returning students. And so the requirement is that also within 72 hours of their return, they get another test, hopefully getting that result back before they return on campus. Hopefully that's a negative result, of course, as well. If they haven't had that test or haven't gotten that result back by the time they arrive, the campus should offer immediately to provide tests to those students to make sure as quickly as possible we know whether they're positive or negative. So let me sort of pause there. Again, the higher ed piece is certainly doesn't impact local municipalities directly, but it certainly impacts communities and the extent to which there may be risks associated with students either returning to communities from colleges or coming back to college towns at the end of Thanksgiving. And so hopefully this will be a positive a step to try to ensure greater safety and make sure that we're not spreading the virus unnecessarily.
Thank you, Secretary, very much. There are a number of questions in the chat already. I do know that, we had received some emailed in with the invitation that goes out. There's an option for people to send back in. And we have received a question just to ask for a comment on the CDC shifting recommendations regarding in-school learning, just because we know that, that's a priority of yours and just wanted to hear either from you or from the assistant commissioner on your take on that shift.
Well, so we're, you know, and we've been obviously, you know, talking quite a lot about this, the governor, lieutenant governor, the commissioner and others, to both clarify I think highlight what the growing evidence is from a medical point of view, but also from an educational and a social, emotional and mental health point of view, the importance of students being in school as much as possible. We certainly understand there are a lot of logistical, you know, complexities about making that happen. But the importance for students is in many ways kind of incalculable. And the concerns that we have that students are not only learning precious time, are losing precious learning time, again, notwithstanding the best efforts of schools and teachers to provide remote learning opportunities for students, it's just not the same. but also the isolation that students are experiencing, the general impact that all of this is having on mental health issues that may have existed before COVID, but are now getting worse, as well as developmental issues, both related to general social emotional development, but also in particular related to students with special needs of various kinds. The inability to have normal routines, the normal human contact, the direct relationship with the kind of hours that are really required in person with teachers and with peers is just a huge loss that we feel strongly, if we don't take steps to address urgently, are just gonna be very difficult for us to compensate for after the fact. We're already digging a hole for ourselves. And again, the pandemic is doing the digging primarily, but we need to do everything we can to sort of swim against this tide in order to mitigate those losses and the damage that's being done. And equally important, and the thing that I think everyone on the call I'm sure is aware, are the impacts of this absence of in-person schooling are being unequally felt across our communities and within our communities across various groups of students. Unfortunately, the students who really need school the most may be getting it the least. And that's just something that is going to create, much deeper gaps, both from a learning point of view as well as a developmental point of view, that we just need to take very seriously, regardless in some ways of what the overall environment is looking like with respect to COVID. I mean, we obviously have to take that into account in everything that we do, but school is the one thing, and Lieutenant Governor has been very eloquent and persuasive on this, is the one thing that we're doing all of those other things for. The reason we're taking all these steps to contain the virus and to make sure we're being safe in the broader community is to make it possible for children to get back to school. And we just need to keep our eye on the ball.
And we are doing a lot of testing. We're one of the highest states in terms of the amount of testing that we're doing and the amount of tracing. And the army of contact tracers out there, including your local boards of health, to understand where the clusters are developing. And we're not seeing schools as the place where the high incidence of clusters is developing. That coupled with, we are a state that from early on when we started the reopening process was very diligent about the safety protocols that were incorporated into workplaces, including our schools. You can't really compare apples for apples what's happening in Massachusetts to other states, because we are very aggressive on testing, on tracing, and on our safety protocols, our compliance and enforcement and interventions.
Thank you very much, Mr. Secretary and Governor. I apologize, every once in a while I have to close my video because we have motion detectors set up for energy conservation. And when the lights go out, I have to wave wildly in order to
I do too.
So if I disappear for a second, it's just to turn the lights back on. We have a number of questions regarding testing, in multifaceted. One is concern about access to testing, given the rise in the waiting in line. And if people can't get to the stop to the spread sites, then there's a financial cost that's involved in that. And in some sites, kids can't get tested and others can. So the questions essentially are on, what's the plan? Is there a plan for increasing the testing site availability, figuring out how asymptomatic people can be able to have access to tests, and in avoiding the long lines that make it harder for people who really do need testing because they're frontline workers or in a critical position. And then there's one question, the first one in the chat. There's a question about stop the spread sites locations closing on December 31st. So just trying to figure what the state's plan is to address all of those issues.
Let me just do very high level, and then I'll leave it to the experts to fill in the details. First of all, I think everyone is aware of CVS and Walgreens able to provide free testing. So that is something that people can do. The other is our Stop the Spread sites are where they are, and you know where they are. Those are being managed, and I know that they're being utilized a great deal right at the moment, and we're all going to have to do our best with what's available there as we get through the holiday. The regional Project Beacon sites, the one in Revere, is very popular, and we're learning how to evaluate that and see if there is a more regional approach to some of the free testing. And also communities, if you have CARES Act money available, and Sean Cronin might be able to talk about this as well as the DPH, you can set up your own free testing for residents within your community utilizing the CARES Act funds, especially if those funds are going to expire by the end of December. It would be a good use of those funds to set up free testing within your community.
Are the Stop the Spread sites discontinuing after December 31st?
No, I don't know. Can someone speak to that? There might, how those will be funded?
So I know they're currently funded through December 31st, but you know, as part of the just ongoing consideration of testing in Massachusetts, they usually, the command center usually does an evaluation of testing availability and need, and then makes a decision about, you know, whether or not there can be an extension. There've been a few extensions since they started in, I think, July or beginning of August. I think that's probably being reviewed right now, and a decision about that would be probably coming in mid-December. But right, currently the contracts go through the end of the year.
We've been asked to raise the point that at least one Board of Health said that the MEMA map of where the testing locations are is kind of difficult to navigate, especially for the average person who may not be familiar with it. So if there are ways to have other formatting where residents can check to find where the sites are, that would be very helpful as well. What I think we'll just try and do is run through as many of these questions as we can, as opposed to trying to group them. I think we have time to cover it. The next one is, there are rumors abound regarding an early retirement plan for state employees. Is that happening? And if so, would municipalities be covered?
There is no early retirement plan that is being rolled out at this time.
Thank you. It's always good to, the rumor gets started, I know, and then we just know it becomes an organic thing. So that's good information to have early in the process. The next is regarding outdoor dining. Question from Mayor Holliday, please confirm outdoor dining terminates on November 30th, and then any more information about extending the CARES Act deadline.
So I think Jess Bellevue from my office answered the question about outdoor dining, and that municipalities have the ability to extend outdoor dining to a further date or until 60 days after the state of the emergency, whichever is sooner. And she puts the link there to the order.
Thank you. That encourage everyone to go to the chat and to scroll and find that. Thanks for posting that. A related question that came in via email was a longer range regarding the support for downtowns, for restaurants and so on. Asking if the administration has plans to continue providing that support as we go through the winter and the spring.
Yes. Well, of course, we highlighted about $100 million in our budget proposal. I know that was largely focused on small business relief and relief to businesses that were not able to or were not eligible for PPP. The legislature did reduce those sums, but there should be more funds available there. At some level that we would like to quickly put into the hands of business owners to make payroll, to pay rent, to keep operations going. The shared spaces in streets program, very successful. We have another round open now for winter outdoor spaces and streets. So be creative as you are. And we have another $10 million available through HED for planning, for municipal planning with your business community. Doing marketing survey, you know, getting input from your business community. What are your current needs? What are your needs to bridge to post-pandemic times? How can we help? So there's a couple of grants right there that are open now that you should take a look at and see if they can help you. And we have an economic development bill that is before the legislature that contains a lot of the resources we need to work with you on community and downtown initiatives, infrastructure for housing, workforce development. There's a lot of resources plugged in there that we would like to see processed and available to all of you.
Yes, MMA is a strong supporter of that, and we're hopeful the legislature will report that out soon. There's a question, we have a lot of questions. So there's a question about the differential in positivity rates between the general community and schools in particular, just trying to figure this out. New York City talks about 3% positivity rate in the city, but 0.23% in the schools. So they're just trying to figure out what the data means as we hear it in how to reconcile essentially what's safe and what isn't.
Yeah, and I may ask Russell to jump in here. I mean, I think there are sort of two points on this. One is these could be a little bit of an apples and oranges comparison in terms of the testing protocols and rates, so that, you know, looking at one number versus another may not really tell you very much. The other is, you know, the point I mentioned earlier, which is that transmission in schools seems to be quite low. Some of this has to do with, you know, just the way in which the virus seems to interact with young children, but also in terms of the protocols and the safety procedures that are in place within those schools. So, schools, obviously, at the end of the day, children and staff go home to their communities, and so they are part of their communities, and that whatever is going on in the wider world is certainly going to affect them. But there's very little evidence to suggest that what's going on during the regular school day when they are together in the building is driving any of the sort of increases that we've seen in positivity rates or just cases themselves. Russell, anything you want to add to that?
So the only thing that I would add is that the way in which we've created the guidance around how to interpret the health metric, the weekly health metric, and the color-coded information that we receive for every community, how that relates to schools and the decisions that we need to make about, in-person learning versus hybrid or remote. We've continued to update that. You know, we've done it twice once the original metric was created and now with the new metric. And I can put that in the chat just to guide people there. But it's really about how do we understand what's happening in the community to decide what should happen in the schools. And, you know, as the secretary said, really with this push towards, you know, safe in-person learning because we know it can be effective. And the final thing that I'll just mention quickly is that I think I've spoken to this group previously about the mobile testing unit and the ability to provide that resource just so that we can, you know, double down on the effect of transmission in schools. Is it occurring? What do we know? And I'm so pleased that the mobile testing unit is up and running. It seems very smooth. We're hearing that it's going out, it's doing this testing, and it's reconfirming what we know about transmission in schools and how low it truly is.
Thank you. Next question has to do with reimbursement for voting by mail and early voting. It was in the year-end closeout legislation that the legislature passed from last March or last the earlier spring election. There's a plug in there that since this is an unfunded mandate, that there be continued funding going forward to fully reimburse communities, especially if it's made permanent. And that would be the MMA's request as well. A question about vaccines being distributed. Any more information regarding that process? Just a concern about making sure that the communities are fully integrated into the vaccine distribution process.
We are working with municipalities and particularly with local health has input on the vaccine planning. And while there's a very kind of high level plan in place, we do anticipate that, you know, depending upon when, you know, the vaccine is available, there is a kind of a phased approach that's really dictated, and we're anticipating that we would be really engaging with the communities in far more detail around kind of say phase three, which is when the general public is able to be is able to access the vaccine. So, you know, we'll have a lot more information coming. We're really communicating with local health on this, and we were able to go over that information with them on Tuesday to kind of give them a sense of time frame. But that's something that we are we anticipate rolling out more details as they become available.
Thank you very much. And there's another question aspect of that question, just encouraging that there be financial support for communities, since there will be a need for them to step up resources and personnel to assist with this, either through FEMA or through state assistance. Is that a part of the planning?
I'm sure it's part of the planning. Like I said, this is a, you know, I don't want to speak for everybody here. It's really all hands on deck kind of approach. So I know that that all of that is being taken into consideration.
Thank you, Commissioner. Just a another question, just a plug by a local official, Kelly Clark, saying that boards and committees and people are getting accustomed to remote meetings. And is there consideration to provide permanently providing this authority going forward after the public health emergency ends?
Well, as you know, this is a partnership, and we listen to you a lot about things that are working. And as an administration, we always find things that are working and try to do more of it. So this might be one of those areas where both in state and local government, we find that this type of remote hearing process can work. We'll have to examine that with you and see what is most effective. Obviously, wanting public input and accessibility to be considered as part of that going forward. I do want to, there was someone that mentioned about CVS and Walgreens, because I think I raised that as a place that you can go for a COVID test. It is free if you're insured. So I want to just clarify that for the chat. If you have insurance, that is a covered cost.
And if someone is on, for example, MassHealth, that would be a covered cost through MassHealth, correct? Yes.
Can you confirm that on public health?
Yes, all insurance will cover a test that is necessitated either by having symptoms or being a close contact. And we have standing orders in place for that.
Great, thank you. There's a request that the state stand up additional Stop the Spread sites that are geographically distributed around the Commonwealth as cases surge, or, you know, in all parts of the Commonwealth. This question's came in from the mayor of Newton.
Yes, I know we, Mayor, we have discussed this before about the Stop the Spread sites. We're looking at regional capacity, and as well as municipalities setting up your free testing with your COVID funds.
There's a question in the chat. It was posted to panelists, so the general audience can't see it. It has to do with the Maven system that's being used by health departments when COVID information is provided, which then allows the community to begin contact tracing and comparing to information that's directly shared with our health department. For example, a resident's positive for COVID to when the information is received from Maven is up to 72 hours. Is there a way to deal with that processing gap? To provide more real-time information to communities is the question.
No, I appreciate that, and thank you. We have occasional situations the way that Maven gets that information is the laboratories report that data directly to Maven. So it really is an issue of laboratory batching the information that they give to, that they send in through the database, and then the upload of that. So if people are finding that there's a significant lag, and particularly if there's a lag associated with a particular care site or a laboratory, please reach out directly, because we are communicating with people one-on-one on those circumstances to make sure that tests are reported to the MAVEN system as quickly as possible. Usually though, the providers and the individual who has been tested gets a notification about it a little bit sooner. So, and particularly where we have standards in place for businesses and with the schools, we've encouraged people to report that information directly. So to further decrease the lag time. But if there's an individual that's having a particular problem, please don't hesitate to reach out. We'll follow up on that.
Thank you. There's a question regarding the gathering limit and its impact on fall and winter town meetings. Although I believe that town meetings are not covered by the gathering limit as a municipal legislative body, correct?
That's correct. And I believe you have the specific guidance for that.
Yes. Thank you. We are moving through these. So the question regarding the New York quarantine when entering or returning to Massachusetts, what support will be forthcoming to support enforcement? So I guess the broader question, if you wanted to consider it, is just generally there are more states on the do not travel list, more restrictions and that's happening throughout the country. And the question generally is enforcement of that and how that is happening.
Well, I mean, it's been the same since we issued our travel order or advisory. And with the exception of Maine, New Hampshire, Vermont, and Hawaii, you must get a negative test result 72 hours prior to arriving in the Commonwealth of quarantine for 14 days. That's been our travel guidance from the beginning. I think most people are rule followers. Most people want to do the right thing. And I think most people understand that it's important to understand their status when they're mixing up with other people, especially older people or people that might have an underlying condition, and that people need to take this responsibility seriously and not put either themselves or others at risk. And need to understand what the purpose of this is for.
Thank you. There's a question from two people regarding the opportunity for retirees to go over the 960-hour cap in calendar year 2021. That's an outside section in the pending legislative budget. We hope the administration supports extending that through fiscal 21.
We know that it's, we have been supportive of it, and we know that it is effective. We will hope the legislature will take action, and when it reaches our desk, we'll evaluate that.
Thank you. There are two quick school questions. One of them has already been answered in the chat, which is there's a direct link in the chat to the DESE's FAQ regarding ventilation, if folks are interested in that. Question for Secretary Pizer, is the advice on testing students before leaving campus advisory, or is it a requirement?
You know, I was hoping to answer that HVAC question, but now that you've taken care of it, I'll go on to this other one. So it is advisory, but I would say it is strongly recommended. It is, we've set it as an expectation, and as the Lieutenant Governor indicated, we think people do want to comply, not just because we tell them to, but because they know it's the right thing to do. And so my expectation is, to the greatest extent possible, they're going to try to live up to that expectation.
I encourage people to look at the end of the chat. There are some posts from administration officials regarding the various guidance and information that has been made available, including Executive Order 50, which is the one that provides the ability to extend outdoor dining. Just trying to go through these again, more concerns regarding the long lines at testing sites, There's a question, is there any possibility of priority testing for first responders? This person knows of several communities that are having difficulty with continuity of operations because of the wait times their first responders are having. And then just trying to see if there are other questions at the end. Let's see. Just trying to scroll in. There are a number of issues on the CVS question. We'll be providing some clarity in that as a follow-up.
I see the Gloucester mayor will take anyone's unexpended COVID funds. And I don't know, Sean, if you want to speak to that. It's come up a couple times, I think, around what happens December 30th if you have unexpended COVID funds.
Yeah, and as I typed in that, Mayor Full, I have no greater insight than anybody else, but I would strongly suggest, and I say this on, we have CEIT calls on Mondays with municipalities, you know, as the experts tell you what you should be doing and you have monies available, use those monies for what you're being, what's being suggested to do. Just because the second round has closed, if you remember, communities had to submit their second drawdown back, I think it was October 15th. There's a reconciliation round coming up in December. So if there's expenses that you've incurred since then and projected out to December 30th, you'll be able to get reimbursed for that. So spend the money. Obviously, it's going to be eligible, but spend the money on all the things that the experts are suggesting that you spend it on.
Thank you also in terms of, it's just still up in the air question as to whether or not the December 30th deadline is going to be changed. There's a likelihood that if it is changed, it ends up being changed retroactively. That doesn't help decision-making right now. It just means that the Congress will finally, will, and the president, either the current or the new one, will deal with that later, early in the year. I am trying to see if there are any new questions that have not already been covered. A question about screeners and contact tracers. Jana, any update in terms of that?
Right. So in addition to all the contact tracing that's done at the community level, and there's a huge amount of contact tracing done at each community, the Community Tracing Collaborative, everybody's heard about the CTC, is there as a support. And while there have been some increases in the amount of time that it takes to get to a positive case or to a contact, just due to the numbers of cases increasing in Massachusetts, they definitely are staffing up. They're onboarding new staff. They got a couple of hundred starting on Monday. So they onboard the beginning of each week. And there's a staffing plan to be able to really reconcile kind of cases that have been taking a little bit longer and being on top of it. So we're ready to support municipalities with that additional staffing. Another thing that's we're also recommending to municipalities is if they have staff who need training in Maven to do this contact tracing work, they can piggyback on the CTC training. And we'll be talking about that more on my local health call tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. So we're really going to be making additional resources to get local staff up and trained so that their supports, we know everybody's busy and they've been working really, really hard to stay on top of this. So we, in addition to the new staffing, we're going to have training.
Thank you very much. We have covered, I think, in at least in broad sense, all of the topics that were raised in questions. And we have come to the top of the hour, Lieutenant Governor. I have a note that our next briefing is scheduled for 10 a.m. on Tuesday, December 1st. So that's a different time, same day, Tuesday in 2 weeks, but 10 a.m. of Tuesday, December 1st, we will send out the invitation and the notice as soon as we can in a way that is relevant to the timing of everyone's booking their calendars. But that comes after the Thanksgiving holiday. So Lieutenant Governor, I'll turn it over to you for some final words, but before doing that, I want to thank you and Secretary Pizer and Commissioner Johnston and Commissioner Ferguson and Deputy Commissioner Sean Cronin and all of the members of the administration for the support and the partnership that you've given us and the cities and towns of the Commonwealth. We hope that you can find time for joy and relaxation on the Thanksgiving holiday. And we look forward to continuing to work with you throughout the rest of this pandemic. So Lieutenant Governor, turn it over to you to close.
Okay, thank you all for being on, all the panelists, as well as everyone participating in the chat and online. This is a great exchange once again. I wish you a safe holiday. Thank you for doing your part, getting the message out. The more we can emphasize to people to do what they need to do and be responsible, the better things will look after Thanksgiving and heading into the holidays in December. And of course, we want to finish out this year strong and get into 2021 in the best shape possible. And it won't happen unless everyone does their part. So I just want to thank you all for your hard, hard, hard work. None of us want to go back to where we were. And frankly, given all that we've done together, I think we're in the best position we could be in heading into Thanksgiving. And I wish you some joy as well as you get together with those closest to you. And thank you very much. And we'll see you on December 1st.
Thank you, Lieutenant Governor. Be safe. Be well, everyone.
Bye-bye.
Bye.